Welcome to Energy Law Roundup, your comprehensive weekly briefing on legal news and developments in the energy industry from Texas and across the country, always in 30 minutes or less. And now, your host for Energy Law Roundup, business litigator and oil and gas trial lawyer, Tom Charlone.
It is the week of November 19th, 2018. Again, my name is Tom Charlone. I'm a litigation partner in the Houston office of Kane Russell, Coleman & Logan, where I have the privilege of leading our firm's energy practice group. Joining us in this week's episode of the podcast is my partner, Marcy Rothman. Marcy will speak to us about digital signatures, an increasingly critical issue in today's legal landscape. Marcy is the managing director of our firm's Houston office. She's been practicing law for over 30 years, has personally participated in over 100 trials, two-thirds of which she has handled as lead trial counsel. Marcy began her practice in Beaumont, Texas, during the heyday of Jefferson County as a plaintiff's venue. She has worked in the refineries, plants, shipyards, and waterways in that area at a time when no other women were working there in heavy industry. Marcy responds 24/7 as part of Go Teams, providing legal, incident management, and investigations support for catastrophic incidents involving oil and gas rigs, pipelines, railroads, trucking, and downstream facilities. Genuine trial lawyers are an increasingly rare breed, but Marcy is unquestionably on the short list of attorneys in Texas who can legitimately call themselves trial lawyers in the truest sense of the word. Marcy, please take it away.
I am going to be talking to you today about electronic signatures. I started thinking about why this matters, and I asked myself as I prepared to have this discussion today, why that is the case, since, as you will see, some of the legislation has existed around electronic signatures since 2000. Part of the reason that we started getting involved in the question of the viability of electronic signatures is because our energy clients started coming to us and asking us whether or not electronic signatures could be used in a variety of different applications in their day-to-day business, from transportation to employment to filing of UCC documents. We were getting questions about that on a regular basis, and so we started really looking at the issues, and our involvement in that organically grew. I asked myself for a minute, why now? Again, the statute, just at least one of the major statutes, has been on the books since 2000, and I thought I'd start with a story, and then I'd explain why I think this is an issue, and then I'll launch into the topic. In 1994, I got an AOL address, and it led us into the world of dial-up and email and that sort of thing. It was new at the time, and my law firm had no idea what that meant. It was new. At the time, I represented Mobil Oil, now ExxonMobil. And they came to me and they said, we insist that you have email and that you have this other newfangled invention called voicemail. And I went to my law firm and I said, we need to have email and voicemail. And they looked at me like I was from Mars. And so I did a little research and I told them that if they would agree to pay for the line, that I would acquire a domain name with the firm's name in it. And I would use my AOL address and all the firm email would come to my desk and I would handle it. And they agreed. And that is how the firm email started. And obviously it's evolved, but I think part of what has happened is that the ideas and the technology, both the software and the hardware, are starting to catch up with each other. Email is a foregone conclusion in terms of communications. iPads in the field, whether they are DOT trucking logs, whether they are, I see the HR folks nodding their heads, whether they are DOT trucking logs, whether they are contractual methods for having somebody come to your house and do inspections, whatever it is, we're seeing the software and the hardware catch up. And now people who are in the energy industry want to do deals as quickly as they can. They want to evaluate the terms. They want to move forward. The electronic method is something that is front and center on their desks. So I think that's why it's happening. I think what we're seeing is ideas, legislation, software, hardware all coming together. And there, frankly, has not been a large amount of litigation over the viability of electronic signatures. Obviously, the formation of contracts has been well explored over the years, but the viability of the electronic signatures is a different question. And so For That Day has happened recently for one of our clients, and For That Day has happened several months ago for one of our clients when the CEO or the chief operating officer or your head landman comes to you and says, I want to sign all of these contracts electronically and I want email to suffice. You may have some sense of going forward what the viability of that idea is. So that's what today's discussion is about. I first need to give credit to my partner over there, Danny Guerra, the man with the beard in the back, who is responsible for the written materials here today. So in Texas, I'm going to talk to you first about the electronic signatures under what we call Chapter 322 of the Texas Business and Commerce Code. That is the Texas adaptation of the Uniform Electronic Signatures Act. I'm going to talk a little bit about case law. I'm going to talk a little bit about electronic filing and how that works with electronic signatures. And then I'm going to show you a few examples and some practical considerations. Chapter 322 of the Texas Business and Commerce Code is the codification of our statute here in Texas. Why am I going to talk to you about the codification if sort of the whys and the hows are more important? Because this is going to wind up being a fact-intensive set of inquiries, and your considerations are going to be fact-intensive. And the things that I want you to think about as you go forward when you leave here today, when you're answering these questions, are a little bit fact-intensive. So I want you to have the concept and the fabric of the ideas in mind as you move forward. The purpose of the code is to facilitate electronic transactions. It is based on a national model. As I told you, around 1999, and you'll see in a minute, in 2000, there were some predecessor statutes enacted, and I want you to be familiar with the fact that these things are out there. Why? Why the uniform transactions? And here are the reasons. The first thing is, as you might expect, they're industry drivers. They're transaction drivers. They're production drivers. We want to eliminate barriers to commerce. We want to simplify, clarify, and modernize. We want to promote uniformity. That's an issue. We want to promote the development of infrastructure for these kinds of transactions. And we want to promote, most importantly, as you see going forward, the public confidence and the validity and the integrity, the reliability of the communications. That's going to be a continuing theme as we talk today. Despite the model legislation in 1999, it was not adopted by all 50 states. Congress decided that this was an important element of our transactional world, our commercial world going forward, and they passed a statute, a federal statute in 2000 called eSign. eSign requires states to adopt a statutory companion to it, or it will be governed by the model, or the state will be governed by the model. The UETA, the Uniform Transactions Act, has been adopted by 47 states, as you can see. New York, Illinois, and Washington have adopted something similar. At this point, essentially, the state statutes will govern. As a practical consideration, and we looked for this as we were preparing for this discussion today, we looked for disputes where, for example, somebody signed something in, let's take an energy state, in North Dakota, and another party signed something in Texas, which statute will govern. We were unable to find that litigated. And so what we point out to you as a practical consideration is that you may specify that the parties have agreed to transact business. If you want to specify Texas, then specify Texas. If you want to specify North Dakota, Oklahoma, wherever else you may be, specify that state. Let's talk about the application for a minute. Chapter 322 in Texas, and I am going to focus on the Texas statute. It It applies to transactions between parties who have agreed to conduct transactions by electronic means. That's going to become important. What does it mean to agree to conduct business by transaction means? And what kind of evidence is necessary to demonstrate an agreement that you have agreed to conduct business by electronic means? And the statute addresses that specifically, the question of whether the parties have agreed to conduct a transaction by electronic means is determined from the context and surrounding circumstances, including the party's conduct. What does that mean to you as business people? That means to you that there's some uncertainty around the definition. It means to you that the different courts evaluating context and surrounding circumstances may decide to find a way to distinguish the facts before it if they want to enforce an agreement. They may try to find some facts that lead them to articulate that the context or the surrounding circumstances support the notion that the parties agreed to do business electronically, but it's not a bright line test. That's my point. It is not a bright line test. So what we're going to talk about going forward is that if you want to do business electronically, how do you build into your transaction the types of things that somebody looking at your transaction in hindsight will say, from this context, from these circumstances, we find that the parties agreed to do their business electronically, agreed to sign this contract electronically. It does not apply to wills, testamentary trusts, or most provisions of the UCC, so that's important. And with the UCC, I would say yet. We received a question about that from one of our clients. Here are some of the clarifications from the official comments. The scope of the Texas Act is limited by the fact that it only applies to transactions related to business and commercial and governmental matters. If you skip down all the way to the bottom of this particular slide, you will see that the Act applies to UCC Articles 2 and 2A because they are two-party transactions. That applies to the Article 2 and 2A are sales and leases, and from the standpoint of people involved in the energy industry, the sale or lease of heavy equipment, the sale or lease of cranes, the sale of product, the all kinds of things that are sales that are not otherwise required to be documented by the UCC are appropriate for transactions electronically. And the things that are excluded right now from this are matters, obviously we talked about wills and trusts, that's not highly relevant here, I don't think. But Articles 3, 4, 4A are excluded because they impact payment systems, that's negotiable instruments, bank transfers, letters of credit. Articles 5, 8, and 9 are excluded because they are being revised right now to incorporate terms and requirements and provisions for electronic business. 5 is letter of credit, 8 is investment securities, and 9 is secured transactions. So those things you should be careful about. Let's talk about the next element of this. What is an electronic signature? An electronic signature means an electronic sound, symbol, or process. That's piece one. And the second piece is that is attached or logically associated with the record. That's going to become an area of controversy. What is logically associated with the record? And remember that part of this element and part of the fabric that we talked about when I first started talking was the idea that these transactions be reliable, that you be capable of authenticating them, and that they be supportable. So the electronic signature means electronic sound. What does that mean? And we have not had an electronic sound case yet, but what we think it probably refers to is when you're on the phone or when you are talking to somebody and they say, I need to read these questions to you and you need to respond out loud. In all likelihood, and I think you'll find if you search your memory that you're being told that you're being recorded. And electronic sound may very well be your response to those types of questions. That's less of a commercial environment and more of a personal application, I think. I'm not aware of any pinging or other types of sounds right now that might indicate assent to an electronic contract. But attached or logically associated with a record, as we'll see, becomes relevant. The third piece of this that is important is that it has to be executed or adopted by somebody with intent to sign the record. Intent is important. And again, back to circumstances and context. What does intent look like in circumstances and context? As you're starting to build your back-end processes, particularly HR and other types of agreements, what does intent look like as you build your back-end processes, as you work with your IT to design the interface? This is going to be important. And I'll tell you that Danny and I have had some litigation around these sorts of things. We've had litigation around the agreement to transportation tariffs and which versions. So when we talk about the logical association of a tariff to a contract, which version of the tariff applies, we've had litigation around that, and that can be very difficult in hindsight to do architecturally. Again, I think probably the software is starting to catch up, but we have been litigating those issues for a number of years. Electronic signatures count. A record or signature in Texas may not be denied legal effect or enforceability solely because it is an electronic form. A contract is enforceable. It cannot be denied legal effect or enforceability solely because electronic record was used in its formation. Email, SAP interface, all kinds of things like that. If the law requires a record to be in writing, an electronic record can satisfy the law. So we're going to talk about the statute of frauds in a minute, what needs to be in writing and what doesn't. And if a law requires a signature, then an electronic signature in Texas obviously satisfies the law. It can satisfy the law. I talked about the logical association of one document to another, notarized documents. So you no longer have a notary stamp. When you walk down the hall to the notary who takes her stamp out of her desk and stamps it, that is an electronic contract that's no longer as prominent of a feature. And so the Commerce Code specifically deals with that. If a law requires a signature or a record to be notarized, verified, or otherwise verified, the requirement is satisfied if the electronic signature of the notary or the other official is attached to or logically associated with the document of record. So how that looks, I haven't had a notary case yet, but we will test, I'm sure, at some point, the logical association of a notarized verification to a signature. So we'll talk about some cases. Right now there are three immediately prominent cases in Texas. The first one is a 2017 case called Corey versus Tomlinson. Corey invested $400,000 in a company owned by Tomlinson to fund the sale of crude to Syria and to Kurdistan, if I remember correctly. And Corey became unhappy with the viability of his transaction, and I don't know why. But he went to Tomlinson and asked for repayment. Tomlinson's company was unable to repay, and Tomlinson assumed the personal responsibility. I didn't see in the case that there was a personal guarantee, but for whatever reason and whatever way, Tomlinson assumed the personal responsibility for repaying that debt. They did it by email, and Tomlinson, of course, breached. Corey's email to Tomlinson setting out the terms of repayment was sent to Tomlinson. Tomlinson replied by email and said, "We are in agreement," but he did not include his name or a facsimile version of his signature. And he did not include a signature block, and things devolved into litigation. The parties agreed in this case that they were governed by the Electronic Transfer Act, Electronic Signature Act, and so that is a distinguishing factor here. They agreed to that. They also had express language that said that we are in agreement. The court concluded, interestingly, and we're going to see other courts that say different, the court concluded that the name or the email address in the from field satisfied the definition of a signature under existing law. So keep that in mind when your land man makes a deal or sends an email saying, I think we have a deal, or we have a deal, or we will perform, and then comes back and says, well, that wasn't a final document. We've had a couple of those issues come up. And so remember that in an email context where somebody puts an email together and says, we are in agreement, and by virtue of the circumstances and context of that email, the court decides that that suggests that there was intent to agree. The court finds that placing a signature, an email address in the from field is sufficient, that there is case law to back that up. You'll note, and I'll draw your attention to this, this is a Houston First District 2017 case, and for those of you who are not lawyers, it shows at the end of the parenthetical, no petition. What that means is that nobody petitioned for appeal to the Supreme Court for a determination of whether that, what the Supreme Court would think about that. So that is not the, in Texas, the Supreme Court is the highest form of authority. A petition denied case where the Supreme Court looks at it and says we're not going to take this decision any further is the second most significant kind of authority. This, a no petition case, is the third most persuasive kind of authority. Context and circumstances. Walmart versus Constantine. You'll note that this is from Dallas, our neighbors to the north. It is a 2018 decision, so it came out this year. Walmart sought to enforce an arbitration agreement that it said its decedent, and I'll explain that in a minute, signed by clicking through a computer-based learning module. How many of y'all in your companies, and you don't have to raise your hands, but just sort of mentally think, have I been through a computer-based learning module? I'll tell you that we have had some of those. I suspect that most of you have those in the context of your work environments. And what happened in this particular case, and this is of particular importance to the HR function here, I know there are a number of you here today, is that a Walmart employee was threatened by a third party. He called the police. He informed Walmart that there was a risk to his life on the premises. Later, the third party came back and shot and killed the guy. And the family of the decedent sued. Walmart sought to enforce arbitration rather than have that case litigated in a state court. Obviously, it landed in Dallas, in the Dallas state courts. Walmart sought to enforce the arbitration agreement that was contained in the learning module that the employee had run through as part of his training. And his family said that essentially it was a his family said that essentially he didn't know what he was signing. There was no evidence that he knew what he was signing, there was no evidence that the signature was his, that there was no evidence that he intended to agree to arbitration by clicking through the boxes. And the court looked at the entire learning module, looked at the circumstances, looked at the context for this, and said that he was required to log in. He was required to put in his employee ID. He was required to click through a series of questions. And that indicated his intellectual presence, his intellectual availability, his acquiescence, his acknowledgement, and his understanding of what he was doing. And the court enforced the arbitration provision. Context and circumstances. And I'll tell you that we recently were asked for advice by an energy client on how to deal with exactly this, the separation of an employee based on electronic interface. And what we advised the client to do was to build in click boxes and to build in some of this language. And also, instead of saying, I acknowledge or I understand what this is, we also advise them to build into their interface, I agree, so that there is a manifestation of intent. Next case, a petition denied case. So I remember I told you that the highest form of authority is the Texas Supreme Court, and then the second highest form of authority in case law is petition denied, meaning the Supreme Court has looked at it and has decided not to take on the decision or alter it. Is this Mitchell versus Mitchell case? Several brothers attempted to negotiate. They lived on ranches, family ranches adjacent to each other. There were some mineral rights involved. There was ownership of the partnerships that managed and held the ranches involved. And the brothers exchanged emails regarding the exchange of interest. So one brother wanted to hold his father's ranch. And in exchange, he sent an email to his other brother saying, you can have Mother's Ranch and you can also have the mineral rights if you just let me have Father's Ranch. And there were a series of emails. There was no indication of assent. There was no indication of agreement. As a consequence, the court found that there was no manifestation of agreement. But also, and I should have mentioned this with Corey, and I didn't, and I'll mention it also in the context of Mitchell. Both of these cases had statute of fraud elements to them, and what that means is this. In Texas, there are several kinds of contracts that must be in writing. They must be in writing, or they must be enforceable within a year in order to be enforceable. You can't just have an open-ended contract that is not put in writing, and for things like the transfer of land, things like the acceptance in Corey, the acceptance of an obligation to pay a debt for another. In Corey, what happened was Tomlinson, remember, personally agreed to satisfy the debt of his company. The acceptance of an obligation to pay the debt of another is also something that has to be in writing. And so what happens is, if the court finds that the parties do not intend to sign, or that the electronic signature in some way is otherwise deficient, then there's no writing to support the contract and the contract will fail. And that's exactly what happened in Mitchell. There was no assent, there was no agreement, and in addition to that, the statute of frauds was not met. Interesting side note, one of the appellate judges who wrote this opinion is somebody that Danny and I litigated a very hard adverse possession case against in Round Rock before she ascended the bench, so that was interesting. Using electronic records and e-signatures when dealing with state and local governments, this is important for the energy environment. Texas agencies and local governments may allow the e-filing of documents, including real property records, and they may accept e-signatures. The important piece is every agency or local government has to have some uniformity around their rules. That's the important piece. You can look up online to see which kinds of counties and which agencies have these provisions. 60 counties in Texas currently accept the electronic filing of real property records. This is a little bit different than e-signature, so I just want to draw your attention to that distinction, that it can be scanning a document and then e-filing it. We as lawyers do that all the time. Memoranda of leases, those kinds of things all can be filed electronically. In 60 counties around Texas, I guess there's 254 counties in the state, 60 of them we can verify currently accept the electronic filing of real property records. Generally what happens is the counties will designate 5 or 6 electronic vendors and everybody is required to use their selection from among those vendors. The bigger counties do this, and there's a list of counties here. Hidalgo, Jim Wells, Nueces, Victoria, Bear, and so on. Ector. What should you do? If you want to transact business electronically, include express language. The parties consent to enter into this transaction electronically. The parties agree that this agreement may be executed by electronic signatures. If you don't want to transact business electronically, include an express disclaimer. Say that you don't want to. Say that your signature at the bottom does not constitute an electronic agreement in any form or fashion and does not signify acceptance of a proposal. In the employment context, as we've already discussed, require an employee to sign in with a unique password with a unique ID. Within the account, require an express agreement, not an acknowledgement, but an agreement to sign electronically. Require the employee to open and read, scroll through a document. I'll tell you that on my phone, when I scroll through the iTunes renewal, I don't read it at all. I'm sure that they'll hold me liable in some way, but responsible for my purchases. Require the employee to agree not to acknowledge or consent, as I've said. We have some examples. This is a residential lease example. We just wanted to show you sort of how this works. As you can see, the documentation here is an IP address and it shows the date and time signed. And this is the college dorm lease for Danny Guerra's daughter. So there you have it. We note that it doesn't show his guarantee.
But they know.
This is a Harris County e-filing. This is a real property record. And as you can see, the receipt at the bottom on page 3, the documentation of the fact that the document was not only e-filed. Remember, I told you there's a difference between e-filing, e-recording, e-signature. It was also e-recorded in the official public records for Harris County. This is another personal example. This is an example sent to me by my accountant to sign off on my tax return. And it has all of those questions I have to click through in order to identify myself as the person properly signing. So there's a verification that it's me. There is, and that is the end of our, that's the end of our talk. I hope it's helpful. If you have any questions, please give me a call.
Thank you for listening to Energy Law Roundup. If you would like additional information about anything from today's episode, you can contact Tom at 210-446-6999. Or by email at tom@charlone.net. New episodes of this podcast are available every week on the web at www.energylawroundup.com, your one-stop source for breaking news and developments in energy law.